Hi, I'm Frank Spotnitz. I produce The X-Files, and you're listening to The X-Cast.
Welcome back, everybody, to The X-Cast. The truth is in here. I'm your host, Tony Black, and this week we are looking at episode 4 of season 1. We are taking a little back step from the nomination we had last week, and this episode is Conduit. And this week, I am delighted to be once again joined by Mr. Andrew Brooker.
Hello, thank you for having me back again.
Pleasure. Okay, let's launch into discussing Conduit. Conduit is the fourth episode of the first season of The X-Files and was written by Alex Ganser and Howard Gordon in their debut script for the show. It's also directed by Daniel Sackheim and aired on October the 1st, 1993. The story involves Mulder becoming personally connected when he and Scully encounter a young boy who is deeply affected by the disappearance or possible alien abduction of his teenage sister. Conduit, then, is one of the early X-Files, and where would you rate it, Andrew, on the 10 scale?
Cool. See, I think I might be a bit against the grain for this one. I don't think I'd give it more than a 6.
Oh, right, okay.
I mean, I know it adds a little bit to the overall lore, and I know it's following on, as the mythology episodes go, it's following on directly from Deep Throat and just adding to the story so we can kind of get caught up with all the characters, but I just thought it was a bit slow. And doesn't tell you much, and man, I don't know if he had an off couple of days, but David Duchovny looked a bit cardboard in that episode.
Yeah, I think, again, we're still at the point where they're trying to establish character and trying to find their way through certain ideas. I wouldn't necessarily rate this much higher than you. I mean, it's certainly not an 8, 9 or a 10. I'd veer between a 6.5 and 7, and I'd probably end up plumbing for 7, because I think Conduit as a story, it's a bit of a mess. It's a bit all over the place and it doesn't really know what it is. But I think in terms of the personal side and the emotional connection, it's a really, really good story. And it's a really important one for Mulder at this juncture.
Without a doubt, I think it's definitely, you know, for us as viewers and trying to get to know Mulder, I think it's very important. And it is important, you know, to tell his story, to give a little bit of backstory to the thing like with his sister and how he is and why he acts like this. I think you're right. You know, the story just seems a bit all over the shop. There are certain bits that kind of appear, and then obviously we'll get to it a little later on, but the bit with the NSA code in, you know, in as big of their quotes as I can't do over a podcast, you know, it's there and then not there anymore. It's completely forgotten about.
Yeah.
The episode itself is a bit wishy-washy. I mean, don't get me wrong, the bits that add to Mulder's story and the bits that add to the mythology in general are very good, as they always are, but I think the episode that they've wrapped it up in isn't the best.
No, I'm inclined to agree with that, really. It has good bits and it has bits that falter a little bit, and it's obviously coming off the back of a really, really good episode in Squeeze, probably the best episode in terms of structure and story and writing yet of the show. So it's got a bit of a hard act to follow, and people have just been a bit side-footed by having two alien episodes and then a monster of the week, and then they're back into aliens. So I tend to think that maybe if they could see their time over again, they might have left Conduit to maybe episode 6 or 7, just to give the idea of more paranormal episodes a bit more breathing room.
Not try and shove all the lore down our throats quite so quickly.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Let's move into exploring the episode then. So we begin with a relatively classic sort of UFO lore teaser. We're at campsite 53 in Lake Okoboji. Okoboji? Okoboji.
I read this before I watched the episode to refresh myself. And I don't care how many times they say it, I've been reading Okoboji.
Okoboji's funnier. You'll keep Okoboji. And obviously, you know, you've got a family in a camper van, a mother, a younger boy, and a teenage girl, but then there's a violent shake, a bright light outside, and the young boy, Kevin, he's screaming that his sister Ruby's gone. So you've then got the mother like looking up into the sky, screaming for her daughter. And it does have that sort of, you know, classic kind of X-Files teaser feeling to it, doesn't it, really? It's, you know, it's got that setup all there.
Absolutely. It's like all the good teasers do. It's advertising big things coming after the titles, isn't it?
I think there's a few good little things in it, though. I mean, I like the way that the mother, Darlene, burns her hand on the door as she's about to move out. I thought that was a good touch because it suggests, again, that there's something genuinely weird that's happened here.
Absolutely. It, like you say, it gives a feeling that there's something going on. And you're almost, because of the way the episode's set up, you're almost certain it's an alien thing. You're almost certain it's, you know, there's UFOs and abductions are coming. But yeah, it's definitely, like you say, the way she burns her hand, it is classic alien lore as well, isn't it? Like the superheating of things.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So it's another example of the show establishing its mythology points, because you see that a lot throughout the rest of the series with alien technology or alien encounters. There's always burns. And I think that's something that even before they'd figured out all the mythology, it's good that those pieces were in there this early.
Yeah.
So obviously we then have the credits, and after that we've got a scene in which we're back in the office of Section Chief Blevins, who doesn't actually appear after this until like the very end of season 4. And I do wonder why that was the case. And then obviously we get their ultimate boss with Walter Skinner much later in the season, but I wonder why we didn't see Blevins again.
Do you think it's maybe for no other reason than people just didn't much like him?
Well, possibly.
Didn't test very well with audiences, and they wanted somebody maybe a bit more likeable, because Skinner is very likeable, isn't he, as a character and as a boss and as an FBI agent. You know, you can't help, even when he's, you know, being an ass to Mulder, you can't help but want to root for him.
Yeah. He's got more charisma, hasn't he, as an actor anyway, Mitch Pileggi. But this guy, Charles Schioffi, I think his name was, who plays Blevins, he's just a bit boring, isn't he? He's kind of like a boring boss figure. And I think they possibly thought, well, what can we really do with him? But of course, you know, at the beginning here, we've got Scully still reporting to him, and, you know, Blevins is asking about how Mulder's taken a case based on a tabloid headline, which is, I think, a classic sort of Mulderish thing to do, which is the headline, "Teen taken from tent by aliens." I love the fact Mulder just sees that and goes, right, that's a case.
Yeah. Does it remind you of the newsstand in Men in Black?
Yeah.
That's where they get all their tips from, just the daft mags.
Yeah, the National Enquirer and all those. But obviously this is where Blevins shows Scully the X-File on Samantha. And obviously Mulder's sister Samantha is the key underscoring emotional component of this episode, and it fuels why Mulder does what he does in this episode. Yeah. But it's interesting how it's Blevins who gives Scully that information and says to her, go off and make sure that he doesn't go off on one with this, because, you know, he's clearly, right from the offset, we're being told he is clearly relating to his own past with this case.
Oh, absolutely. And you do get that, the feeling when he hands it over. Because Mulder hasn't been hiding this file, has he?
No.
You know, not in the slightest. But because it comes from Blevins and goes to Scully, you're kind of forced into thinking that absolutely this is going to be, you know, this kid must have been abducted by aliens, because Samantha must have been abducted by aliens. Sure. I think it's very much pushing the idea of the underscoring rule.
Yeah.
Wow, can't even talk to you. But, you know, it's pushing the idea of everything that pushes the whole series for the entire 9 seasons. It's not being subtle about it, which I think is good, because this early on, I don't think you can be that subtle. You need to get the ideas out, because otherwise, you know, you're going to lose your audience.
Yeah, exactly. No, I think that's right. And I think that it's one of those scenes that also helps, again, use the word underscore, the point that Blevins is still after trying to nail Mulder.
Yeah.
And in this case, he's trying to go after him through his emotional state. But what I like is that Scully is at a point by now where she says, look, let me talk to him. She's not just going, yeah, okay, let's get him. She's much more now trying to defend Mulder than she maybe would have done even 3 episodes earlier, which I liked, because it's showing that progression while allowing us to contextualize some information on Samantha and just, like you said, put those facts out there so people can understand clearly what Mulder's emotional story is.
There's absolutely, you know, the emotional connection between him and the case. And it's nice that the show makes it obvious, I suppose, the best word for it. You know, it doesn't sugarcoat it. It just says, you know, he's doing this because, yeah, he believes this is the exact same thing going on.
Yeah, definitely. So then we get a scene in the office where Mulder's briefing her on the case and the idea of UFO hotspots like Lake Okoboji. And there's some nice interplay where, you know, Scully's talking about the headlines in these magazines and she comes up with the, she says, how is this more likely than the 100-year-old mother with the lizard baby?
Yeah.
Which is great.
Great that he just comes up with an explanation for it. Straight away, off top of his head, he explains why.
Boom, that's why. I do wish we'd had the episode about the 100-year-old mother with the lizard baby, though.
Yeah.
I think they missed a trick there. They could have had a great episode, a comedy by Darren Morgan.
We've got 6 episodes coming.
That's true.
In a few weeks, you never know, do you?
That's true, and Darren Morgan is writing one of them, so, you know, you never know. So, yeah, it's a scene where, you know, helps us to understand a little bit of a bit more, and it's, you know, it's the nice pointing out that Scully's a little bit like, well, yeah, and then he points out that Darlene's name is in the paper, so it's like, there's your connection. And I quite like Mark Snow's music in this, because there's almost like a flute going on at certain points that gives that kind of like an alien-sounding kind of riff, which I like. I can't explain it, but it's there at various points, and it's in this scene.
It kind of almost felt, because he was doing it, you know, you heard it as she was reading out the newspaper clipping and he was doing the thing with the projector. It added to the revelation that she was in the old newspaper clipping.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking. Yeah,
it added to that very well. Now I think about it, definitely got an alien thing to it, hasn't it?
Yeah. So, yeah, it's just adding a little bit more to the scene, really.
Absolutely. It's still kind of planting that idea in your head that, you know, no matter what gets said, this is going to be an alien abduction. I think you're right. It does sound very alien.
Yeah.
It works very well.
And then obviously we're off to Sioux City, Iowa, which is where they meet the family, Darlene and Kevin Morris. Immediately, certain things are set up in this episode. Darlene being a protective mother, Kevin being a bit weird because he's scribbling away and he doesn't really say much. He's one of those classic sullen kids, and you get quite a few of them in the X-Files, don't you, over the years. There's always episodes that revolve around children. They're always quite sullen and quiet and weird.
they're never happy-go-lucky kids, are they?
No.
Happy-go-lucky kids tend to be left alone with the X-Files.
Yeah, it's just, understandably, given all the weird shit going on around them. But there's that important scene as well where Mulder's looking at the picture of Ruby and he touches her picture affectionately. And obviously at that point, he's not seeing Ruby at all. He's seeing Samantha. Yeah, at that point, he's not seeing Ruby at all. When he touches that photo, he's seeing Samantha. And when he strokes the picture a little bit, you know, it's adding that emotional element to the investigation. And Scully sees it all.
Does he think he's doing it kind of inconspicuously? Because you kind of get the feeling that he's all on his little lonesome in a little bubble when he's doing that.
I don't think he realises anyone else is there at that point. I think he's so locked in to what he's doing, to what he's thinking about, that he forgets. We haven't seen him like that so far. He's always been driven, but he's had his head screwed on and he's been focused. In each of the cases we've seen, this is the first time he's distracted and everything's too raw and close to him for him to be able to cope.
It's very close to home for him, isn't it?
Hugely.
You kind of see that awful look on his face when he looks at the picture and strokes the picture. And yeah, it's a nice moment for Scully to see him that open and raw, I suppose.
Yeah.
It's a very nice moment for them to, as a partnership.
Definitely.
See that, because he's always kind of covered stuff like that up till this point with jokes.
Yeah.
And at this point, he doesn't. And I think for her and for us as an audience, I think it sticks out quite a lot. Mm-hmm. So, well, man, this is, you know, this is beyond just a little bit personal.
Yeah. This is deep, goes deep for him, definitely. I think then we get what I think is one of the night, and there's two moments in this episode that, even though it is a bit of an unfocused episode, there's two moments that I think are really pure X-Files, which I love. And this is the first one, where Mulder goes to speak to Kevin and he's drawing binary code on the paper, and then the TV in front of him is on static. And when Mulder says, "What's that? What's going on?" And he points to the TV and he says, "It's coming from there."
Yeah.
And that's it just sends a bit of a chill down my spine, because the idea of a static TV anyway is creepy in itself, the visual of that. But then the idea that he's writing code and Smulder's face as if to go, "What?" it's great. I think that's a great X-Files moment.
And something that I think is one of those things, actually, that quite, it's a little sad. it does date it a bit because we don't get static on our TV anymore, do we?
That's true, actually, yeah. That's a good point, actually.
You know, I get static on my TV when I accidentally switch it to TV tuner when I turn the Blu-ray player off.
That's the only time you ever get static now, isn't it? But yeah. That's so rare in this day and age.
You know, it's one of those things that, I mean, I suppose if you went, if I showed it to somebody that had never seen the X-Files before, do you, you know, maybe even like a teenager, you know, do you think they'd understand what was going on?
Makes you wonder, doesn't it, really?
But the code coming out the static, it's quite a, it's, I don't think it's, I'm sure I've seen it in other things before, and I really want to say that they'd done that in Mercury Rising, but I might be wrong. It's been a long time since I watched Mercury.
Well, I think they did, but that was after this. Yeah. Mercury Rising was 1998, and I always thought with Mercury Rising that it's a little bit like Conduit in places. There's like, I reckon they'd seen this episode.
Yeah.
Or Bruce Willis saw it and he went, you know what, I'm going to do next, you know.
I'm going to do this exact episode in a vet.
Yeah. So, yeah, that's a really, really effective moment, I think, to establish that there's something weird going on with that kid. Also, then we get Mulder and Scully are doing their bits of investigation. This is the first ever moment we see Danny as well. Well, we hear Danny, I should say, over the phone. So Mulder's contact at the FBI cryptography, who he's basically the Vera from Cheers or the Maris from Frasier of the X-Files. You never see Danny, but it's always, thanks, Danny. and in this case, he offers him tickets to a Redskins game for what he needs to get the binary code.
Yeah.
But I love that. I love where he says, look, I know a friend who knows a friend who knows a friend who can get you tickets to the thing. Yeah, that's a nice little thing to point out. But this is where Mulder's getting a bit frustrated with law enforcement over Ruby. And this is a different, with the sheriff here, it's a different kind of frustration than in Squeeze, where he was actively being ridiculed and he was being, you know, pushed off the case. That's not the case here. It's just that they're just a bit lax.
Yeah, they don't seem to care enough to do anything about it, do they?
Yeah, they're like, oh, well, you know, she's a teenage girl. She's, you know,
turn up one, you know, sooner or later.
She was a bit of a wild child, you know. She's probably just off drinking and, you know, having a bit of sex. And then, you know, the whole idea that Mulder's going, yeah, but her mother was abducted, you know, by aliens. And he's saying, well, yeah, but she's been talking about that for years. You know, it's like,
yeah.
It's that whole idea that he's coming into a small community who know and think that Darlene is a bit odd and think that the family are a bit odd. And they don't want to know. Which frustrates him, obviously, because he can... Again, it's the personal side coming out. But this is the point where I think it goes a little bit... And there's a few moments where it goes a little bit into soap opera territory, where they end up following the note from the friend of Ruby's.
Yeah.
They meet in the library stacks. And it just feels like it's from a different show, that.
It does. Well, it doesn't feel like it's from a law enforcement show, does it?
No.
And especially, you know, as the years go on with the X-Files, you'd expect something like that from someone that's going to turn out to be a long time bit part, giving them little bits of info, not just some random who wants to chat in a library.
It just feels a bit off, doesn't it? It just, you know, and it's that whole, it does have that element of soap opera, which ultimately is part of the plot with Ruby and the boyfriend and, you know, and the fact that he got her pregnant and things like that and they were going to leave town. It's just... And then they go to the biker bar where they find out that the boyfriend's disappeared and they meet the guy behind the bar whose ear was burned off by what he calls killer sunburn at Lake Okoboji. But it doesn't feel like the X-Files, some of this, I think, in this plot.
No, it feels very much like it was taken from a long time running drama.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's not taken from a sci-fi show. It's literally like it's been pulled directly from a soap opera script.
Mm.
Yeah, all it needs is for someone's kid to have been raised by pirates.
It does
kind of, I mean, obviously not like that, but it does travel into pretty absurd realms, even for the X-Files.
Mm.
It's the completely wrong direction for any X-Files episode to take, but this one, it felt disjointed.
Yeah, it did. And then of course, you've got the... immediately after that, that's when the NSA show up, which you mentioned earlier as being quite as sticking out quite a bit. And you know, they burst into Scully's hotel room, and the agent walks in, and he wants to know where the binary, because he faxed the binary string to Danny. They've picked it up, and you know, he wants to know where it's come from, because it's from a defense satellite transmission. And you're like, well, hang on a minute. 2 minutes ago, we were talking to a you know, a girl who was talking about her mate's boyfriend being knocked up, and now the NSA are here.
Yep.
You know, decide what you want to be was what I think when I watch it.
Yeah, see, I had pretty much the same reaction as I was watching it. They went, you know, oh, part of a defense satellite stream that, really?
Yeah.
No. It was so absurd. And I was like, someone has put this in because I don't know who in the writer's room decided they wanted it in, but it literally got inserted and then forgotten about because it's not really mentioned again after that.
No, it's not. No, they're completely, I don't think you see the NSA again.
No, and considering the pages and pages of binary that this kid draws out a little bit later on, you'd expect a little more, wouldn't you?
Yeah, just a bit. You'd expect it to be that they're a lot more central, this transmission is a lot more central to the actual story.
Yeah.
But it just feels like it's thrown in there to add that extra element of government conspiracy and, you know, the men in black. You know, it just feels a bit contrived.
It just seems far too coincidental that of all those pages that eventually get written up, that one original page is the one that's a defense spy satellite.
Yeah.
I mean, you've lucked out there, really, haven't you? Lucky if you turned up 20 minutes later, you'd have handed over the completely wrong page.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, it doesn't make an awful lot of sense. And it feels like a show that's trying to cram in different elements in order to keep the mystery going when it didn't need to be all of those things, and it should have chosen a path.
Cramming, I think, is the right word as well. They've literally squeezed in as many different stories and hoaxes and whatever that they've heard of to go, see, this, it really is alien stuff. Really, honestly, it really is.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, he's trying to dance at you and go, look, it is.
Yeah.
There's also a point with that Scully actually tells the NSA what they want to know, and Mulder's like, well, why did you tell him? And I get the feeling that Scully of, like, 2, 3, 4 years later wouldn't have said anything to them. I think she would have just not given them anything. And it just seems to me that it's a little bit like, at the beginning, Scully still doesn't have that element of passion and trust for the quest.
No, I think you're absolutely right. At this point, she's still loyal, for want of a better word, to the FBI and to the authority and to that. She's not, while she follows Mulder, and she follows Mulder more these few episodes in, she's still not quite as dedicated as he is at this point, is she?
No, she's still a bit dubious of it all. And
yeah, and she's still very much, you know, she's still the FBI agent, and she's the FBI agent first. So she, you know, she does the authority thing, you know, these people are in charge and it's the NSA, I have to tell them.
When a few seasons later, she'd have gone, no, I'm not giving you anything.
Absolutely. She'd have thought, gone, you've got no chance.
Yeah, exactly. Also, going back to the transmission, afterwards, when they go back to the office, the field office, they find out that the transmission is a series of data from, like, a Da Vinci's Universal Man, a DNA double helix, segments of music, lines from the Quran.
Wasn't this it was the Voyager thing, wasn't it?
Yeah, it seemed like the Voyager thing anyway.
Without really ever mentioning, because when I watched it the other night in preparation for this, I'm like, this is the Voyager thing, this is the stuff they put on Voyager, and it just wasn't mentioned. How do you know all that and not mention the fact that it's from Voyager, which is pretty famous?
But the thing is, I don't think that I think you're absolutely right, it's from Voyager, but I don't think that they thought of that, because they used the Voyager thing in later on in Little Green Men at the start of season two. That's a big part of that. Yeah. But so I think they just copied the Voyager idea for this, which in theory is a neat idea, but it's just like, well hang on a minute. Why would they have a Defense Department transmission that was that for a start? So it just there's lots of little dead ends with all this, and you think, well, why is this here?
It's a very messy episode.
Yeah, it's just lots of little strings and of ideas that don't necessarily lead anywhere. And this is why, going back to what we said at the beginning, it's the emotional components that make it a 6.5 to a 7, really. Yeah. And if it didn't have any of that, it would be a lot lower probably, because it's just all over the place.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if you didn't make it a personal episode for the people involved in it, it would probably be one of the worst episodes ever.
It would be, yeah. And that's why there are certain duff episodes later in season one that we'll get to talking about that don't have this emotional connection and just don't work. And, you know, Conduit would have probably ended up being one of those. So obviously we get further into the story, and the NSA have brought Kevin in to find out what's going on, and Darlene, now, like, she doesn't want anything more to do with Mulder and the FBI, even though he's saying, look, I still need your help. And I still need Kevin because obviously he's got some connection to whatever happened to Ruby, and he's trying to put all these pieces together, and Scully's all going, well, you don't know any of that yet. You know, there's still pieces of this you haven't filled in. And it's a bit of a stroke of luck, I think, that when they get to the campsite and they find that the sand has been heated like to, you know, 2,500 degrees and has become glass, that they then see that wolf that leads them to the burial of ground of the... It's a bit like, it almost feels like an idea from Lost, that you'd see like an animal in that leads you to a body.
It's a bizarre way to do it, again, for the X-Files. For some other shows, it would have been fine, but for the X-Files, it seems like a really weird and almost ham-fisted way of revealing the next bit for the plot.
It feels like they didn't know how to get to the point where you find out that Greg Randall, the boyfriend, is dead.
Yeah.
And they went, right, well, okay, let's have a wolf appear randomly. Because wolves like dead bodies. So yeah, they see the wolf that goes into the forest, and they find a note inside the wallet of the dead guy, which leads back to the girl who they saw in the library, which is Tessa. And I think that this is again where we go into, you know, this point of Mulder becoming obsessed, still becoming obsessed. You know, there have been a few scenes before this actually where he's getting further and further down this rabbit hole. You know, when he talks to Darlene and Kevin, when they reject him, it feels like he's losing his sister again. And it's Scully's talking to him in the car, and he's still not admitting that it's about Samantha. And he's getting more possessed when he's uncovering the body and he's throwing the rocks away. And she's saying, stop.
Yeah.
And there's lots of little points that I think that's what it does really well. It builds up this growing compulsion in Mulder that he has to find this girl, because in a way, it's like it's like finding Samantha.
Absolutely. He's got this kind of desperation, hasn't he?
Yeah.
You know, even if there's nothing there, he needs to find his clues. I mean, you'd almost think, actually, mentioning the wolves and that earlier, you know, if this had been any other TV show, that would have been his hallucination taking him to that body.
Yeah.
And you're right, yeah, that he's absolutely desperate and, he's compulsive about finding this. You know, digging up this body, and he wants to find the girl because he is, as far as he's concerned at this point, I think he's looking for his sister.
He can't distinguish the two. You know, he's sort of transmuted Samantha into Ruby, and because he can't, because he hasn't been able to psychologically cope with what happened to Samantha, he's seen this opportunity to find somebody who's missing, and he's just made it about him. That factors into when he's interrogating Tessa, and he plays a lot more harder cop than we've seen him, you know, and he's getting more. You know, he's trying to draw the truth out of her about how he was killed and things like that, because he's trying to get her to admit that, you know, she knows a bit more about Ruby than she lets on. And that's where, again, that's where it doesn't quite work with the soap opera-y sense of this, in that it kind of just is at odds with the rest of it.
Yeah, I think it's trying very hard, especially when he's interrogating her, a bit like the thing with the picture a little earlier on. You get to see a different, you know, not composed...
Yes.
Side to Mulder, where he gets very angry and almost visceral in his reactions. You know, we get to see it, Scully gets to see it, Tessa gets to see it, and it's something at this point we're not used to. And I think the point of that is to shock us into going, you know, again, this is very close to home for Mulder. But you're right, it doesn't fit at all.
It feels a bit off. And I think that it does play into, though, his psychology, which is the good side. And then it also plays into the next scene when Scully finally just confronts him about this and says, look, stop looking for your sister. What I quite like about this episode is that he doesn't ever talk to her about this properly. It's that classic kind of thing. It reminds me a little bit of how in Skyfall, with the James Bond film, you never ever have a scene where James Bond talks about what happened to his parents. Everything you find out is externalized, and it's always through other characters.
Yeah, it's always through pictures and...
Yeah.
Stories that other people tell other people.
Yeah, and he almost never ever says anything about it at all. And that's what happens with Mulder really in this, in that it's almost always through the prism of Scully or Blevins or other characters, and you just see moments where Mulder's seeing things or doing things, and it's his actions and not what he says that drive this. And I think that's a really good piece of writing.
Oh yeah, that part of it is definitely, it's very well written, and it's where he gets to chase Samantha by proxy, while everybody else, including us, we kind of get to learn about Samantha by proxy. and you know, we don't get to hear his side of the story for quite some time.
I like the way he turns around to Scully. He says, look, follow me or don't follow me, but I am not giving up on that girl. And he just goes.
Yeah.
And it's like, and she does follow him. And that's the whole thing with the two of them, in that she's, as the series and the seasons go on, she, whenever he does say that, and he just goes off, and she will follow him because she believes in him. And that's what you get from this. She's frustrated by him, and she wants him to be honest with himself for the good of the case and the good of him, his own mind.
Yeah.
But she goes with him anyway. And I like that. And it's further deepening their relationship.
Absolutely. I mean, I think even if she can't believe in what he's chasing, I think she can believe in his resolve to solve the case, whatever the case may be. And I think that comes through quite well there.
Definitely. Like I said earlier, it's got two moments this episode that I think make it stand out for various reasons. And the other one is back at the Morris house. And this is where we see the mosaic of Ruby. And this is a great image where they're looking at all the binary code on the floor of the house, and Scully goes upstairs and she happens to look down and go, come upstairs. And then we see the image of Ruby in binary, which is a really, really cool image. And it's really creepy, actually.
It's been put together incredibly, hasn't it?
Yeah.
It looks amazing. Even, you know, even by today's standards, it would still look creepy putting that together on the floor in bits of paper. It looks amazing, and it's just, you're right, it's one of those little bits in this episode where, silly writing aside, it look, you know, it hammers home the alien bit very well.
It does. That mosaic was designed by assistant art director Greg Lowen, and his colleague Vivian Nishi had to painstakingly alter the printed binary to make it seem like an 8-year-old had drawn the image. It took days to complete, but the final image only appears for a few seconds, obviously, so... Yeah, it's a hell of, when I was watching that, I was thinking, Christ, the amount of work that must have gone into making that image was, because they, you know, it's not obviously not CGI. That was properly done. That was written.
Yeah.
So yeah. Fair play to those guys, because bloody hell, that must have been painstaking.
Can you imagine how infuriating it would have been, though, putting all that work and watching the episode and it's there for 3 seconds?
Yeah, it'd have been like, fucking hell, I want a whole episode on that. Just them looking at it.
Just look at it a bit more. Look at it again. Don't make all my work about that 2.5 seconds.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. But it's a really chilling image, and I think it's one of the things that makes the episode stand out, really. And then that leads to the slightly strange denouement, shall we say, of what happens. But before then, we've got Mulder, for the first time, and this is perhaps the only time when he does actually open up in the episode, when he's talking about his sister and the psychology of it, and he says he feels like he's still walking into the same room from when he was a kid. And yeah. I think that's a nice image, and it's the only, he slightly opens up, but apart from that moment, as I said, it's all externalized, but it's a nice moment. But the rest of the ending, again, it feels a little bit odd with the bikers driving through, and you do have that really nice image of Kevin walking towards the orange light, which is really sort of a creepy, like, alien looking light. But like the whole episode, it almost feels like a fake.
Yeah,
it feels like a cop-out, in that, you know, the episode has promised a lot of things that he never delivers on. And one of the things is that, were there aliens? Was there an alien thing? Or was it just a bunch of teenagers going out and getting pissed? The point of the X-Files is that you never quite know what happens. But I think in this, it's a case of that the episode doesn't know.
No, this episode doesn't. It doesn't even give you, like every other episode does, it doesn't even give you a vague answer that you could, you know, you want your water cooler moment with these episodes, don't you? Where you can sit and debate whether or not it was real or aliens or not. But this one, I think it does feel, with the bikers especially, it feels like a cop-out. We've now got no explanation for the burning on top of the RV. We've got no explanation for the burning in the trees, the glass. None of that is explained at all. Not even hinted at. And this seems like I've wasted the last hour just so I can see a bunch of guys on Harleys.
Yeah, exactly.
And there are other TV shows for that.
Yeah, Sons of Anarchy, for a start.
Absolutely. With Mitch Pileggi.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Playing a Nazi racist.
Yeah. Oh, but wasn't he spectacular in it, though?
He was very good in it, definitely. Again, it doesn't quite work as a climax, but what does work, again, is Mulder's emotional component when he, you know, when Ruby's back and he wants to talk to her and Darlene shuts him down, and he says, look, she needs to talk about what happened to her. She needs to... You know, and what I like about it is that it's kind of exploring how Mulder would have felt as a kid through Ruby, through what he's saying about what Ruby will be feeling. And I think that's lovely.
I think it's spectacular. It's the when she's going, they're going through her medical reports and that, and little things are explained you know, and again, little things hinted at as to what might have happened, but nothing concrete is absolutely the wrong word for it. But, you know, nothing to give you a possibly concrete answer as to what might have happened. And yeah, him being shut down by the mother is just, it's awful for us as an audience to see him go through that.
Yeah, because he's just really upset by it, really. And but you can understand in a way why she would do it, because she's had that brush with her daughter disappearing. She's had a lot of effect throughout her life of people not quite believing that when she had her own experience supposedly with a UFO. So she just wants to put it all behind her, which you can kind of understand.
Absolutely.
It's just a shame for Mulder. It's again him feeling like he's lost Samantha, and he's lost the opportunity to understand the truth about what happened. And then, of course, it ends with the quite nice moment of listening to Mulder's, well, Scully looking at Mulder's hypnotic regression tape. And there's a really interesting visual here, which I think is Mulder sitting in a church crying.
Yep.
Now, obviously, this is before they got into the whole idea, I think, of Mulder not really being religious and believing in God, which was always an interesting thing with Mulder.
Yeah.
And then you get the final line of the episode is, "I want to believe," which is lovely. But him sitting in a church is, when you look back at the entire series, it's really odd.
it is odd. It's a bit strange, but at the same time, it's a powerful image, I think, at the same time. You know, because a church scene, a pew, whatever you want to call it, it instantly evokes that kind of feeling that you have to go somewhere. You know, yeah. there's somewhere that maybe a little bit of, you know, there's a higher power than you, and maybe they can help and maybe they can't. And whether or not you believe, sometimes that pull maybe can be a bit too much. And because does he have a picture of his sister? He does, doesn't he?
Yeah, I think he does, yeah.
Yeah, so he has a picture of his sister and just like almost silently maybe, or maybe through listening to the tapes at the same time we see him there, almost begging for help.
Mm.
And that, I think, the rest of the relatively ropey episode aside, that is a very strong way to end the episode. It's a very strong image.
I do agree. It's interesting in terms of Mulder's own belief system, as we later discover, but as an image, yeah, it is really interesting. And you know, as an overall episode, even though, as we say, it's definitely flawed in terms of story and structure, in terms of characterization, it's probably the episode that defines Mulder as a person more than any of the others.
Oh, very much so. I'm not denying that it's an important episode, not at all. I think it's one of the most important ones in the early, yeah, in the entire first season, mm. you know, for those reasons. But the episode itself just feels a bit, meh.
Yeah, no. It's a good way of talking. Yeah, it's good. Yeah, yeah. I agree.
If only you could see the faces I was pulling.
If only we were a video podcast. This is times when we need to be.
Yeah.
But yeah, okay, that was Conduit, then. A mixed bag, but one with a strong emotional undercurrent. Okay, next up, we're going to move on to our Do You Believe In section, where I ask my guest if they believe in a certain element of paranormal phenomena that has been prevalent in the episode. In this case, one of the biggest biggest piece of weirdness is the transmissions that Kevin Morris receives. So, Andrew, do you believe in alien transmissions?
Through the TV? Not sure. I remember sitting as a kid looking at the static and seeing the shapes in it, if that counts.
Mm.
But whether or not they came from aliens, I don't know.
It's an interesting idea. The most well-known one was known as the WOW signal. Now, I don't know if you're familiar with the WOW signal.
No.
It was in 1977. It was a brief burst of radio waves that was detected by an astronomer named Jerry Ehrman, who was working at SETI, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, at what's called the Big Ear Radio Telescope in Ohio. And it was it was so remarkable that he circled in the printout WOW in the margin. And that's,
okay.
And the name stuck. And they've never been able to track where the signal came from, but it came from deep space. They believe it's either an astrophysical phenomenon, which they've never seen before, or it was genuinely an alien signal. So that's been the biggest one that definitely happened in real life, where they don't know what it was, but it was definitely a transmission of some kind from deep space.
Okay. No, I'd never heard of that one.
It's a really interesting case because it does make you think, well, what could cause that, such a powerful signal? Could that be from something just randomly occurring in space, you know, or is it an intelligence?
I do very much fall into the camp of we can't be so arrogant as to think we're the only being in the universe. But sending us their radio signals, okay. As long as we don't send them back, we've got some pretty awful music.
Well, that's true. There's also crop signals as well, crop circles, and that people have said that those are transmissions as well from alien sources, apparently. You know, that's been what people have suggested. Obviously, crop circles, I think, have a much more mundane, you know, human reason. But things like Nazca lines, and there's lots of phenomena where things have been etched in the ground over thousands of years that people have suggested might be transmissions from aliens. So it doesn't necessarily have to be a broadcast. It could be something that's been etched into the earth or, you know. And so there's a lot of strange, unexplained elements that could be aliens trying to communicate. But why would they do it that way? Why wouldn't they just come out and talk to us?
Well, maybe they can't. Or maybe they don't know that we would listen. Or maybe they just don't realise that we're intelligent enough to understand.
Perhaps they're operating on an intelligent level that we can't understand either, which is why we can't decipher these things.
It's quite possible that we are the hand-signing apes. They're humans.
Yeah. We're the idiots, who don't understand, and we're not at the level yet where we will. But and I think, considering the people on this planet, I think we definitely are those.
Yeah. Absolutely. I don't think there's any doubt about that at all.
No, absolutely. But yeah, do investigate the WOW signal, guys, because it's one of the most interesting ideas about an alien transmission. So, if you do have static on the TV, just be careful, because if you start writing ones and zeros, then you're going to get the NSA randomly turn up for no good reason. So just be careful. Okay, for the final part of the episode, it's Andrew's most fun moment, and it's the X quiz.
I love this, because by the time all of these episodes I've done to come out, it's going to be a running joke that I'm god-awful.
Of course, Andrew has done this three times before, and he's never beaten his score. He's always got 3 out of 6, but he's never got lower than 3. So he's operating an equal median, aren't you, really, here?
I am. I'm absolutely 100% average.
That's a horrible way to put it, but I suppose it's true in this case. This is your chance, however, to beat your score, to get more than 3. And I've got faith in you. I think you can do this in Conduit. I really do. So are you ready?
Yeah, go on then.
Okay. 6 questions. 5 questions and a quote. Here we go. Question 1. How many wolves are at the grave when Mulder finds it in the woods?
3?
Yes. Well done. You're off at the races. Excellent. 3 wolves.
I've only got to get 2 more right now. It's okay.
Question 2. What does Mulder flippantly tell Scully he'll send the sheriff after she suggests not pissing him off?
Oh, crap.
Not crap.
No, it's not crap. Can't be a box of donuts. I want it to be a box of donuts.
You're not a million miles away. It's a bundt cake.
Yes, it is.
I'll send him a bundt cake. You were close, though, in fairness. Okay, name the biker bar where Greg Randall worked, because you do see the sign of it. The camera pans up.
It does pan up. Damn it. No.
Okay. It's the Pennsylvania pub.
Oh, bloody hell. Yes, it is. Well.
Okay. Question 4. What does Scully recognize the music in the Defense Department transmission from? So what music is in it?
No.
It's the Brandenburg Concerto.
Yeah, that's the one. Blacked out.
Right, you've got 2 more chances to equal your score.
Oh, it started off so
well. It did start off so well. Okay, who reported similar prolonged weightlessness imbalances as Ruby has at the end of the episode? So what kind of person, what kind of vocation?
I was astronaut.
Astronauts, there we go. Yeah, excellent. Which again is another little clue that something did happen to Ruby, but there you go.
The things have dropped from her bloodstream.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Okay, so finally, question 6. This is the quote again. If you can name the character and the scene, that'd be great. So, here we go. That's it, Mulder. You just bought yourself a 1-way ticket back to Washington.
It's got to be when he refuses to tell the NSA agent where he gets the the transmission from.
There you go. That's it, yeah. NSA agent Holtzman is his name in this, who appears briefly and then buggers off. So, yeah, well done. You've got three.
Still averaging three, huh? Wow.
It's a skill in itself to get exactly the same score for four episodes running, I think.
That's not bad going. I'll tell you what, you wouldn't believe it. I've got Pennsylvania Pub written in my notes.
Oh, no.
It's actually there. I wrote it going, yeah, he's going to say that, and I completely fucking missed it.
This is why revision is, it counts. I'll do you a schedule next time.
Wow.
But there you go. You've not done any worse, though. So, you know, you're still there. You can beat this next time, and you will. I have faith.
I have to.
I believe.
You're beyond a joke now.
I believe. I want to believe in you. Okay, that was Conduit, the fourth episode of season one. And we'll be back next week with another nominated episode. And we're jumping a bit further ahead. I won't reveal quite which one that is yet, but we're a couple of seasons in the future again. And it's another quite dark one. So keep an eye out for that. Big thanks to Andrew Brooker for coming on again.
Oh, thank you for having me on again.
It's been a pleasure. We'll be back later on in the season, I'm certain, to equal you and beat your score. But until then, where can we find you, Andrew?
Until then, I'm only really active on Twitter. I spend my time at Brooker411 online. I rant and moan and write the occasional thought on films.
Good thoughts on films, particularly like your Jessica Jones review. That was good.
Thank you.
We, of course, are at the XCast on Twitter, the X_cast. You can find us. We're on Facebook at the XCast. You can email us at thexfcast@gmail.com. Please do. Please let us know what you think of the episodes. We're a few in now, and we're racing into the first season. So, yeah, let's see what you think, and if there's anything else we can do that you might find interesting, let's do it. Let's talk. We're also on iTunes. Please do leave us a review on there. Thank you to those of you who have. That'll help us grow. And we are also on Acast, so you can find us there. Thanks again, Andrew.
Well, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Pleasure's ours. We'll see you again for another file. And until then, remember, trust no one. The XCast and X-Files podcast was created by Tony Black and is produced and hosted by Carl Sweeney, Sarah Blair and Kurt North.
You can find the podcast on Twitter at @X_cast, on Facebook by typing in the XCast, and in our group, X-Files Basement, the XCast podcast fan group, and on Instagram at the XCast Pod.
Don't forget, you can support the show by becoming a member on Patreon. Our patrons get early access to episodes, behind-the-scenes chats with our hosts and a thriving community of X-Files, and other premium interviews and specials. To find out more and subscribe, you can go to patreon.com/thexcast. That's patreon.com/thexcast.
We are also part of the We Made This podcast network, full of popular culture shows, including our Millennium series, The Time Is Now. You can find all of our shows at our website, wemadethispod.com, or via Twitter @WeMadeThisPod.
Thanks for listening, and keep watching the skies.